Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of May 20th, 2011. If you're a victim of a natural disaster, this is not what you want to hear.
The $1,600 that they received from FEMA, they said was just a drop in the bucket. And now the fact that they have to pay it back kind of adds insult to injury, they say.
We'll find out why FEMA is demanding refunds. And times have changed for those with a customer service beef.
Here comes Twitter, and within 140 characters, we can actually get our complaint across to companies, and they can respond to us.
And the Gen X crowd isn't known for being conservative, with one exception, investing.
They've gone through all these kind of difficulties, the tech bubble, the housing bubble, the oil crisis, the gold crisis. And so they don't have a lot of faith in the economy, and they don't have a lot of faith in the market.
And that could hurt them in a couple of decades. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency's mission is to prepare for, protect against, respond to, recover from, and mitigate hazards. As part of that mission, the agency gives out emergency money to victims of disasters. This week, the San Diego Union-Tribune reported that FEMA is now asking some of those victims to return part or all of their disaster payouts. It profiled San Diego residents Veronica and Donald Lytle, whose home was damaged in the wildfire back in 2007. FEMA wants $1,600 back from them and more than $22 million from other disaster victims across the country. Christopher Catalago visited with the Lytles and wrote the story for the Union-Tribune.
This is a rural area, and they are used to fires, and were kind of preparing for the worst, and the fire came up right to their property line. It badly damaged the home, put a hole through the roof.
And was their home destroyed?
Their home was not totally destroyed, but they couldn't live in it for 3 weeks, so a FEMA inspector could come. They couldn't clean anything because it had to be in the condition that the fire left it.
What kind of monetary damage was done to the house?
The home suffered quite a bit of damage. The couple paid, this is just for materials because they did the construction on their own, anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000. So the $1,600 that they received from FEMA, they said was just a drop in the bucket. And now the fact that they have to pay it back kind of adds insult to injury, they say.
So what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to make a check out to the federal government?
Yes, that's actually
wow.
What the letter says, is to just pay the entire thing. They say that they're going to appeal it. They have not done that yet. But they were able to fix some of the damages, but you know, there's a lot of mud caked into the walls and the ground, and they have not fully restored this home. So,
still 4 years later?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What does FEMA say about why the Lytles and other disaster victims should be paying this back? There aren't any allegations of fraud here, right?
No, FEMA has said that none of these cases involve fraud. They kind of derive from a few factors, including people on their end, folks on FEMA's end, misreading some of the guidelines and improperly approving some of these folks. And, you know, people ask the question, why 4 years later? Well, part of that reason is because, you know, there was this legal challenge, and they could not recoup or did not try to recoup the money since about 2007. And now that they're doing it, you know, a lot of people out there have said, why are you coming so late? Well, not to defend FEMA, but they don't really have a choice. It's the first opportunity they have to try to recoup this money.
So they're mandated by law to do this?
Yes, they are. And there's some federal legislation out there which would allow FEMA to, in certain cases, not be mandated by law to seek this money.
Did you get any sense of why a victim of a natural disaster would not qualify for this kind of aid? I mean, what reason is given for the Lytles, for example, having to return $1,600 when they shelled out $15,000 to repair their home?
Some folks did not qualify because they received, according to FEMA, duplicate payments or were helped out by other organizations.
Oh.
And so now they're coming back. There's also issues with insurance, whether people were made whole and also received this money from FEMA.
All right. Christopher Catalago is a reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And we have a link to his full FEMA refund story at marketplace.org/money. Gen X has seen more than its share of financial freakouts. Black Monday, the SNL crisis, the dot-com follies, and of course, most recently, the Great Recession. So it's not terribly surprising that this generation, loosely defined as adults born between the late 60s and early 80s, is gun-shy when it comes to investing. But their skittishness about Wall Street may be doing them long-term harm. Jillian Mincer is the senior investing reporter for Smart Money.
Gen X actually has been conservative from the start. If you think about it, it makes sense. They've gone through all these kind of difficulties, the tech bubble, the housing bubble, the oil crisis, the gold crisis. And so they don't have a lot of faith in the economy and they don't have a lot of faith in the market. So they're going to tend not to want to put all their eggs in one basket in the market. The other consideration is that they're kind of a little laid back. And so even if they have been auto-enrolled into 401k retirement plans at work, they've probably left it at that 3% and forgotten about it. And if they have, they're going to be way behind for retirement.
I am a Gen Xer. And, you know, I have to say that I can understand why the tendency would be toward conservative investing, because we are probably the first generation that never knew a pension. And now we are really the first ones to totally have to manage our retirement on our own. And a lot of it is education. You know, you just don't know that you're doing it right.
You not only have to, and I say we, and there are about 46 million of us, not only won't we have a pension, only about 14% of private employers provide pensions anymore, but we also can expect some really steep healthcare costs.
Right. You know, I wonder if that is affecting an unwillingness to take a risk in the stock market because you just don't know how things are going to shake out.
That's true. But at the same time, we have to expect to at least try to accumulate enough savings to last 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. And many people believe the biggest risk is actually that we'll outlive our assets, especially if we see a lot of inflation during that time.
Right.
The other thing is investing is much more complicated. I mean, it's not just investing in the United States or in Europe. You need exposure throughout the world. You need different asset classes. So it's complicated. So people do have the right to be intimidated. It's okay to invest conservatively, but then you just have to save a lot more.
Right. What's the best way to start maybe getting yourself a little more comfortable with investing in the market or, I don't know, I guess setting aside more?
A great thing to do is if you have a workplace 401k plan, is to use some of the tools on the plan. They all have it. So do all our websites, you know, smartmoney.com. Mm-hmm. And just get familiar with the names of the things, the different types of investments. Just start it. And then every time you get a raise, save some of it, but also put some more of it into your retirement account and savings account. Also listening to shows like yours, reading websites like mine. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really do need to be informed.
You know, we've been talking about Gen X, but I wonder if this also applies to, you know, the generations following Y and whatever the rest of them are called these days.
Absolutely. You're right on the mark there. We're seeing some preliminary data that indicates that Gen Y is even more conservative than Gen X. The one thing that that generation has going for it is it doesn't expect to get Social Security. So
Right. It's
anticipating being responsible for its own retirement and healthcare costs.
So it really sounds like the lesson here for everyone is open a Roth IRA when you're two.
Yeah.
Right?
It sounds that way. But what they found is that, you know, starting young is one of the best things because you have that compounding interest. And even if you're just putting away just a little bit, I remember someone advising me and my husband just put away $50 a month and that really can grow. And this isn't hopeless. You have time on your side, but to start saving and then put it on an automatic, whether it is going into an IRA or a 401k, wherever it's going, just have it taken out every paycheck so you can't miss it.
All right. Jillian Mincer is senior investing reporter for smartmoney.com. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
For more thoughts on how midlife adults are dealing with investing decisions, go to our Making Money blog at marketplace.org.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Let's go to a slightly younger demographic now and ask, when does your kid's money become their own? Commentator Tim Bedore had to contemplate this recently.
My 13-year-old daughter Claire made this big announcement at dinner. Her cousin Laura, college sophomore, just posted on Facebook, "Daddy cried when he saw my first tattoo, but said he loved me anyway." For some reason, the first thing Claire wanted to ask was, "Mom, would Uncle Terry really cry?" My wife laughed and said, "If my brother saw his daughter with a tattoo that Laura paid for with his money, Uncle Terry would never stop crying." Being 13, Claire's mind responded with this gem, "I'm sure Laura spent her own money on the tattoo." Not being 13, I said, "Claire, I can speak for Uncle Terry and assure you there is no such thing as Laura's own money." Claire did not like my take on her cousin's situation and said, "Laura worked some last summer. Why wasn't the tattoo money that money?" "Because working some last summer doesn't get you within screaming distance of paying for even some of college, Claire. Right now, you have all of $300 in the bank. If you go to a college that costs only $300, you have your own money. Otherwise, you don't." But I had to ask myself, when does our money stop being our money? When does Claire get to stop paying us back with good behavior, as determined by us, for what was once our money, otherwise known as her future college tuition? My first answer was never, but that's unrealistic. And really, there is no answer. It's a giant gray area. If Claire pays for 18% of her tuition, receives her diploma, walks over to a tattoo artist on the stage, and gets summa cum laude tattooed on her forehead, I'd be thrilled she got great grades, but angry I paid for most of that tattoo. Yet if she pays for 98% of her tuition, a more obnoxious oak tree growing out of her gluteal cleft tattoo somehow seems more acceptable because I'm only in for 2% of it. Certainly I didn't tell her that. Well, it was all a big misunderstanding. There is no tattoo. What Laura posted on Facebook are the lyrics to a Miranda Lambert song. But thanks to her cousin, Claire, at least for now, thinks us funding her education means us never underwriting any part of a tattoo.
Tim Bedore is a stand-up comedian living in Minneapolis. We'd like your thoughts. Write to us at marketplace.org/money or post on our Facebook page. Attention, college students. Take that summer internship seriously. It could lead to your next job.
That 3 months is kind of a working interview, is how we look at it.
That's coming up later on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. And it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess. How are you doing?
Doing very well. And you?
Hey, I'm doing good.
Excellent. I wanted to ask you real quick about some news that we got earlier this week about Sallie Mae. Apparently, they are dropping interest rates on some of their student loans. Now, I looked at this story and I thought, oh, well, you know, that's great. And then I saw that the interest rate is going to be 9.875% plus LIBOR. This is no deal.
You know, I have a very simple perspective on private student loans. And this is something we've talked about a lot in the past.
Don't
right,
get them.
We get it. Well, basically, it is don't get them. The old idea behind private student loans, which is not a bad idea, is that it was a bridge loan.
Right.
All right, you're almost done with college. You need another $500, maybe $1,000 to finish up. You take out a private student loan. It's not the end of the world. That's okay. But what has happened is that people are relying more and more on private student loans, and they really shouldn't be called student loans.
It's just a loan.
It's just a loan. It's not like if you fall into difficult circumstances with a, you know, federally subsidized loan or a federal loan. Yeah, you can defer payments, you can stretch out payments, you can go into forbearance, you can go into deferment, all kinds of things. Not with private student loans. It's a private loan.
All right. So just don't take them out if you can avoid them, if at all possible.
If at all possible, don't take them out. If you do, it's just a tiny bit of money. And then compare. Is this the right move for you? Is it a credit card? Is it a straightforward personal loan? So just drop the word student out of this loan.
All right. Done. Student
okay.
is dropped. Well, speaking of student loans, I believe our first caller has a question about them. So let's go to Anna. She's with us from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Anna.
Hi. Hi, Tess.
How are you doing today?
I am doing great.
So are you indeed calling about a student loan?
I am. I am about to start graduate school in the fall.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and I have just opened my loan package, and I am a little overwhelmed.
Yeah. What have you been doing since undergrad?
Well, a lot of things. I did my undergraduate and studied, my major was justice, so I studied prisons and law. And then I quickly, after that, went to clown school, which is not the general.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Back up.
Justice right. And clowns. Okay. There's a certain symmetry there.
So how on earth did you go from wanting to study law to, literally clown school? You're not kidding?
No, yeah, it was literally clown school, I know. I had studied theater before, and I was in a public arts high school in Baltimore here. You know, I thought, hey, who needs art? I'll try to get a real job and make a real difference. But, you know, it just wasn't for me.
So this loan package that you opened was for clown school?
No, this is actually after clown school, I got a job as a puppeteer. And, you know, all the lights sort of lit up in my life, and I realized that this is it.
So, I love this. I love this. Okay, so from prison studies to clown school to puppeteering.
That's right.
That's not what you call a straight line.
No, it's not.
So what does puppeteer school cost?
So I'm going to get my master's in puppetry,
okay. And
which actually exists. And it is, at least for the first year, it's about $30,000.
What?
Whoa.
Yeah.
$30,000 for 1 year of puppetry school?
It's through the University of Connecticut.
And how many years is the program?
I'm admitted as a 2-year master's of arts. And then if after the first year, I can apply to do the 3-year MFA. So it's 2 or 3 years.
$60,000.
It's an investment in my dream.
Well, it is an investment in your dream. But I do have to ask, what kind of salary do puppeteers make?
Gosh, you know, it's very broad. I mean, generally, puppeteers have several jobs going at once. You know, I think most of them are working as performers as well as teachers.
But, you know, Chris, the reason I'm asking, of course, is because you're starting to really hear this new rule of thumb, at least for undergrad, that you shouldn't take out more student loans than you're going to make in your first year out of college.
Yeah.
So then, you know, if you're going to grad school and you're going to have, what, $60,000 worth of potential liability there, are you going to make that much?
And the other thing is, do you really need to go to puppeteer school in order to be a puppeteer? Because, you know, in so many artistic professions, there are communities that evolve in neighborhoods, people help each other out. And it turns out that often a master of fine arts or getting some sort of master's degree isn't that important or that necessary.
I mean, that is a good question and one that I've thought a lot about. I don't need it. I could do it another way. But I know people who've done the program. I've seen the work that they come out creating. It is very impressive. And, you know, I want to be at that level. In a pure money standpoint, it would probably involve moving to New York.
Well, then here, I guess we need to get into a little bit more of your life. So what is your financial situation? Would you be able to move to New York if you wanted to?
Well, here's the thing. I also just got married.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you.
Did you both wear big red balls on your nose?
No, he's actually a computer programmer.
Okay.
So which is another aspect of this picture is that, you know, he's an employable, very valued member of society who can always get a job. I have a Roth IRA and I have an IRA and we have a small savings account. We just got rid of a lot of his debt. Mm-hmm. So we have zero debt. How much should I be trying to save while I'm in grad school trying to pay tuition?
Realistically, you're not going to be able to save anything.
Yeah, I don't know how you save when you're paying for school.
Your savings or your investment is in getting this degree, passing your MFA. So I would look at that as the jargon term that we use. It's your human capital. You're investing in your knowledge. You're investing in your skill. You're investing in your career. And you can think about that as saving, right? Because you're going to make some money off of this over time.
Yes.
So the real key toward keeping a decent financial situation is to borrow as little as possible.
Okay. So really,
that's what savings means.
Put it all into as much as I can pay for the tuition up front as
yes.
I can.
But let's be clear. We are not saying to, for example, raid your retirement funds.
No.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Don't touch those.
All right.
Well, good luck.
Okay.
I love this story. I can't even tell you how much I love it. I just, you know, bravo for following your dream. And thanks for telling us about the crooked line from prison studies to clown school to puppeteer school. I love this.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. And now we have Daniel in Palm City, Florida. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. Very well. Do you have any unique studies that you're doing? Any unique talents that you want to tell us about?
No. I finished with my talents at UCLA a few years back. So
okay.
I'm done with studying.
And what kind of accent do I detect there?
An accent from South America. Argentina.
One of my favorite countries on earth. I loved it so much that I went twice within a year.
Wow.
Yes.
When was that?
A couple years ago.
She told me about all kinds of wines, too.
And wines and meat.
Wines and steak. And probably the friendliest people I've ever met.
Oh, that's
just
nice to hear.
Lovely, lovely, lovely people. I encourage everyone to go visit Argentina.
Please do.
All right, so enough dreaming about my next vacation.
Okay.
How can we help you out today?
Well, I'm in the process of a loan modification.
Oh,
unfortunately,
boy.
I bought a house right where I shouldn't have done it, but it's done.
Okay, let me guess how this is going to go. The bank has not cooperated at all. You've had multiple
really
phone calls with different branches of the bank, and nobody seems to have an answer. Nobody knows what they're doing, and you're just fed up.
Well, more than fed up, I'm scared.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I managed to pull a first modification. Loan modification on the first, and I was told...
Oh, so do you have a piggyback loan?
Yeah.
So you have a first mortgage, and then you also have a second mortgage that made up the rest of the mortgage payment.
Exactly.
Okay.
So when I went to meet with the bank representatives a few months back, they told me, we got to work on the first before we can work on the second.
Okay.
Those were their words.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lengthy process. We got it done. It makes sense. It's not wonderful, but it would allow us to stay here.
What, did you get a lower interest rate, or did they modify the principal?
They modify the length, and they modify the rate.
Okay.
So that worked good.
Some relief.
We're now at a payment that we can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ready to move on the second. But it turns out that the same lender now doesn't seem to know anything about the second one.
Doesn't know anything about it?
Third party that's calling me, asking me for the money.
Okay. So the first and second mortgage were initially with the same bank?
Yes, they were.
And now someone else is calling you about the second mortgage?
Exactly.
Okay, Chris, I'm guessing this is a mortgage servicer.
That'd be my guess. I think there are a couple things that we can do. One of which is, if you can afford it, I would work with a real estate attorney, someone in your corner. If that's not going to work, there are some nonprofits that are really doing some good work, like, and they're nationwide. Lutheran Social Services, for example, do a terrific job. And they work with a lot of people to try and settle out situations like this. And so I think you're going to need someone in your own camp to help it. It sounds like you've done a lot of the work on your own.
Yes, I have. Because when I tried to get lawyers, everybody that I talked to wouldn't recommend their lawyers. I picked up the advice from all of them, and I did it on my own. But now I'm concerned, and I'm scared.
And you're scared? You're scared because of the phone calls that you're getting?
Well, because I don't know what they can do. I've been paying again for more than 5 months now, and doing everything that the bank told me to do. But I don't know what these other guys can do to me.
Right. You have some real negotiating leverage, by the way, with the second mortgage, because if for happenstance, I mean, this is not going to happen, but if you did go into foreclosure, remember, the second mortgage gets nothing. Everything goes through the first mortgage. They're actually in a weak negotiating position. But we also don't want you to fall into a scam. There's so many scams out there. You do.
Have you called the bank, the original bank that held the mortgage?
Yeah, and they suggested to have a three-way calling with these guys.
And
when I told that to this other company, they sent me immediately a bunch of paperwork, but they never wanted to have that conversation.
Oh, okay. This is a scam.
I'm not sure.
Maybe it may not
sure
be.
It sure sounds like it.
But it doesn't sound good. Now, you have the right to write what's called a qualified written response. QWR is what they call it. And what this says, and you send it in to your bank. And what it does is then they have to respond, who is the servicer? You got to find out who is this company that's getting in touch with you. Do they really own the paper?
When I mention that to them, they don't know who that is.
Exactly. So once you send this in, they have to respond by law to find out what's going on. And you start also a written record.
Okay. Yeah, well, I always kept that one.
Good.
Is that something that he can find online, an example of that?
He can find online. There are plenty of examples online. The QWR, this qualified written response. I mean, now, you know, you really find out who actually really does own the second mortgage. And then I would consult with somebody, one of the nonprofits, you know, to try and get some additional information and someone in your corner.
Okay. It sounds like you have at least a couple of first steps. I would call your bank again and tell them what's happening. And then also, you know, as Chris said, try a couple of these nonprofits, see if you can get some help.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
No, thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah.
All right. And let's go finally to Cherry. And she is in Woodland Hills, California. Hi, Cherry.
Hi, Tess. Hi, Chris.
How are you?
Hi.
I'm good.
Excellent. Excellent. What do you do here in Woodland Hills?
I'm a clinical pharmacist in a hospital here in the San Fernando Valley.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. And do you have any problems with your mortgage? I hope not.
No, I don't have any problems, thank God.
Good.
But my coworkers fall into the exact same situation that we were just talking about.
Really?
Yeah, and she just got her house foreclosed.
Yeah, I think there are just so many people across the country who perhaps even if they're not going through it themselves, they know someone who is.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, if you don't have a housing problem, then what can we help you out with today?
I have a question regarding a 529 plan.
Okay.
I just have a child 2 months ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. And me and my husband, we both went to graduate school. Especially, I went to pharmacy school, so I have significant school loans.
How much? Give us some details.
When I graduated, it was about 80-something thousand.
Woo!
So I realized how expensive school is. So now I have a son. We wanted to pick a 529 plan, as you guys keep talking about on the show so many times.
Right.
So when I actually do some research, it's very confusing. I don't know which plan to pick, what to pick, what to look at.
Welcome to the 529 forest.
It's true.
It is a forest.
It really is. I mean, we get this question a lot, Chris. But are there ways to know which ones to avoid?
Well, there are. So let me just got a couple ways to go through this. One is by the time your child is 15, 16 years old, you're going to want to have most of the money in cash.
Cash. Okay.
The bill is going to be due fairly soon. So the choices that I like are the ones that are sold directly by the states because they tend to be the low fee options. I do like the conservative age based option, which is automatic.
Okay.
And what that means is you'll be more heavily equity when the child is young, and then it becomes more conservative over time. And again, by the time around 16, you want it mostly cash. If you're not comfortable with putting money into equities, then I would just choose the very conservative short-term bond fund option. You won't make a lot of money, but you do just fine. The money will be there when you need it. Again, this is money where you take some risk, but not a lot of risk because the bill would be due. And the thing, and I think Tess got a lot of calls in 2008 from people who all of a sudden realized because of the drop in the market, they didn't have the tuition for sophomore or junior year.
Absolutely.
And that's what you want to avoid. You want to avoid high fees. Uh-huh. You want to avoid a lot of equity once your child is in college. And so I would just pick a very conservative option, and the age-based conservative option works for many people.
Okay.
How do I know which one are sold directly from the state?
There's a very, very good website. It's called savingforcollege.com.
Okay.
And it's very good information. It's very well researched. You won't be able to do it in one day. But really, you know, a couple of days looking at the fundamentals, looking at the basics. But since you're in California, California plan is a good plan, by the way. So there's no reason not to do the California plan.
Oh, so I just go to the California plan. That would be good enough.
I think it'd probably be fine. But why don't you go to savingforcollege.com, do a state comparison. Just go there and you can do your research.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, Cherry, does that help you out?
Yes, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Terrific.
Guys.
Thanks for the call. Give us a call. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or with your questions, you can also send us an email. Do that at the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Forrest Wilder. I live in Austin, Texas. I'm an environmental reporter for the Texas Observer magazine. Just a standard wallet, folds open. It's camouflage. A couple credit cards, a bunch of business cards, and a few other odds and ends. This is my fishing license, and I carry it in my wallet because I go fishing pretty often. I started fishing at a really young age. I mean, my dad's a hardcore fisherman, and it's what we did for fun. It's not easy at all. In fact, it's really difficult to be a good fisherman, and it requires a real concentration and a kind of awareness of not just yourself, but your environment. It makes you think sometimes like a fish, just kind of a weird headspace to be in. You know, if I was a bass, where would I be right now? It has some sentimental value, but certainly if I'm at work, I keep a photograph of myself on my desk fishing on the Nueces Bay in Corpus Christi. Maybe when I look at that fishing license, it kind of helps me daydream a little bit, get through the day.
Care for some financial advice to go with your latte?
If there's a place where you feel that it's safe and comfortable and a pleasant place to come to, I think that should build loyalty.
We'll find out if coffee and banking are a good combination. You're listening to Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. It's no secret that Americans love to complain. And if you're having trouble getting a response from companies the traditional way, like over the phone or by email, tweet it. It works. And it'll make you feel good about yourself. At least that's what psychologist Guy Winch wrote recently in his column, The Squeaky Wheel, on the Psychology Today website. He says Twitter is a godsend for our urge to complain.
We have a complaining psychology, which is really problematic as a whole, because when we really believe that to complain to a company will take so much time and effort, it won't be worth it. And so 95% of us actually won't complain at all when we have a problem. We'll just go to the competition. Mm-hmm. And we're also really afraid of the confrontation. We really think it's going to be nasty and time-consuming. So we get into this fight mode when we do call a customer service line. And then here comes Twitter. And within 140 characters, we can actually get our complaint across to companies and they can respond to us. And it really bypasses a lot of the fears we have about complaining.
Why do you think companies are responding so much more quickly and with force to complaints on Twitter and Facebook than they would, say, if you made a phone call?
Because they know that when we complain and we don't get a response, we're likely to tell friends and acquaintances about the company and badmouth them and all they've done to wrong us. And they also know that if they respond quickly enough, if they handle our complaints well, we'll be telling all those same people the good story about how great the company is. So it's very much worth their while to do that.
All right. Well, we've got a couple of examples here, and one of them is our very own Stacey Vanek Smith, who is in our New York bureau. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Tess.
We wanted to bring you in because you both posted on Facebook and called out on Twitter something that happened to you. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. It was very late at night. I was looking at my bank statement, and I noticed that I had a bounced check fee. And I noticed that the check that had bounced was like a $250 check from the Treasury Department, which was a tax refund.
The IRS had bounced your check.
I know, which I thought was sort of funny, considering all the money problems that the government has been having lately. So I tweeted. I should also say I do not have a substantial number of Twitter followers at all. I didn't hashtag anything or do any of the fancy stuff that would flag my tweet.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day I had a message on my cell phone from the Treasury Department saying that they really wanted me to call them back, that they'd seen my tweet, that there was no way that this check had actually bounced. I was terrified. I'm still terrified. I know I'm going to get audited next year, Tess. It's going to happen.
So what happened in the end?
Yeah, it turns out that what had happened was I was moving, so the check, I didn't get to the bank until after the 3-month limit, I guess, so that's why it had bounced. So I guess they're rectifying that.
Okay. So Dr. Winch, I mean, she didn't even intend to get customer service from the man, the IRS, but she did anyway.
Yes, and to me what this shows, actually it's a great example of what I'm talking about when I say that our fears are overinflated. We are really worried, not actually her fear of being audited. Who knows about that one? In general, our fear that we won't get a response. And here's another example of just tweeting something and getting a response. And the same is true for many, many companies.
Well, let's now bring in Marketplace Money listener Scott Pakaditis of St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Tell us your story.
I am not a Comcast customer, but there is a cable from them going to my house, which was pulled off the house during a blizzard in the wintertime. So I first used their online chat service to get somebody out there to fix the cable. But what they did is they came out and then they simply wrapped the cable around my phone line, which was not an acceptable solution. I found that a rather absurd thing to do, and I just went out on Twitter and I just said something like, hey, Comcast, wrapping your cable around my phone line is not a way to fix a downed line. And much to my surprise, I got within 15 minutes of me writing that on Twitter, I got a customer service rep from Comcast. Within 15 minutes, yes. That day, they sent somebody out. Then immediately after, went back on Twitter and said, hey, Comcast, great customer service. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Winch, classic example of why this works, huh?
And it's not just that it works, but psychologically what it does to us is that when we complain in general and we're effective and we get a result, we feel empowered and we feel assertive and we feel good. It's really good for our self-esteem, for our psychological mood.
Dr. Winch, I know you wrote an article for Psychology Today recently titled How Complaining Via Twitter is Changing Consumer Psychology. Can you give us maybe a top three tips to effective Twitter complaining?
Yes, the first thing you would want to do is look up the company's Twitter handle or hashtag. The second thing to do is to state that you're asking for help. Right now, if you look on Twitter, most people are actually using company names and hashtags to slam companies, to just say, oh, this sucks or that sucks. So be clear that you need help, and one of the best ways to do that is use the word help in your tweet. And then the other thing you need to do is give some detail about what the problem is. If you're concerned about a flight, mention the flight number. Mention that flight is delayed, that you have an event that you have to get to.
All right. Some great practical advice. And before we go, I do want to get all of your Twitter handles. Dr. Winch, where can people find you?
At Guy Winch. That's GUYWINCH.
Okay. And Stacey?
S. Vanek Smith. So it's SVanekSmith.
Okay. And Scott?
Purple Squirrel 1.
Oh, that's my favorite.
Maybe I'll change mine to Purple Squirrel 2.
Well, thank you all for joining us. And Dr. Winch, thanks so much for giving us some advice here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tess.
And you can find me on Twitter at Radio Tess. I am what you might call a poster child for the summer internship. After my freshman year in college, the good people at Oregon Public Broadcasting agreed to let me work in their newsroom, and they put me on the air. Fast forward 3 years, and they hired me for my first cub reporter job. Suffice it to say, I believe in internships. Fast forward another years, and thanks in part to the Great Recession, the summer internship has become more and more important to graduates. In fact, it's something like a 3-month job interview, Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
For a 2011 graduate with a major in printmaking, there aren't that many obvious job options. So Anthony Capetta threw his name in for a graphic design internship with the Olson Ad Agency in Minneapolis.
I did the online application, and the first callback was to go and make something that sold myself and my creativity only using my cell phone. So I had an assignment.
His cell phone video must have impressed because that put him through to the next round.
Where I came in and met with 4 different people, which was kind of surprising and kind of scary because it was like a 2.5-hour interview.
If this sounds a lot like Capetta's applying for an actual job, that's because he might be. Companies increasingly view the summer internship as a dry run. According to a new survey of major U.S. companies, 4 out of every 10 new hires this year will be their own former interns. Edwin Koch directed the survey for the National Association of Colleges and Employers.
Over 80% of them this year said that recruiting for full-time hires was the primary purpose of their internship program. Now, that's the highest it's ever been.
Koch's survey respondents are mostly large for-profit companies, but the recession-friendly logic applies more broadly. Interns have already proven their talent, and it's cheaper and faster to bring them on board. Koch's research also shows hiring your own interns costs less over time.
they're getting a long-term look at the student, not only just in terms of performance, but the operation within the corporate culture as well. That has tended to produce people who stay with the company for a longer period of time.
That 3 months is kind of a working interview, is how we look at it.
Gretchen Farr runs intern recruiting for Garmin, the maker of navigation devices, flies college juniors to its Kansas City headquarters for interviews. Last Monday, 60 budding electrical and software engineers started their summer internships.
Probably our average is about 80% of interns that work for Garmin receive a full-time offer. And so we try to make those full-time offers to those interns before they even leave for the summer to go back to school.
The rise of the intern-to-hire phenomenon means competition is insane. Garmin's 60 interns came from a pool Farr estimates at more than 1,000. Anthony, the graphic design intern in Minneapolis, was one of 600 people chasing 10 slots. Steep odds. But once you get that internship, the standard advice applies. Dress for success, show up on time, and treat it like your first day at a real job. After all, it could be. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace Money.
Most of the time when you get a letter from the bank, it's to let you know that more fees are on the way or your loan application has been denied. But one bank is going another direction, offering free cups of coffee at its cafes across the country. It's also providing money management seminars and free Wi-Fi. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins visited its branch here in L.A.
Lindsay Davis is like any good barista. He makes a mean latte and a killer smoothie. But at the register, he goes a step beyond debit or credit.
So you got the electric orange card? How's it working out for you?
So far, so good.
Those no fees really help, right?
Davis is one of a dozen barista slash personal finance advisors who work at the ING Direct Cafe on a busy corner in Los Angeles. The company's signature bright orange decorates the windows, along with the words, "Save your money." Inside, you'll find computers and Wi-Fi access. You can buy food and drinks, even T-shirts and coffee mugs with ING's logo. Manager Mike Gerwitz says the cafe is the online bank's brick-and-mortar connection to the public.
You know, the idea behind it is that we want to make banking as simple as having a cup of coffee.
ING has been rolling out cafes across the country for the past 10 years. The next one will open in San Francisco this fall. L.A. resident Ricardo Macias was skeptical.
I was like, really, this is a bank?
But he listened to the barista's sales pitch anyway. Macias has a checking account with one of those too-big-to-fail banks. The account used to be free. Now, not so much.
Basically, I'm not happy with my bank that I'm at right now.
ING Direct, like many online banks, saves money on branches and keeps fees to a minimum. Macias opened a savings account with a 1% interest rate, plus an investment account.
This place makes you feel a little bit better about banking.
I mean, I think they're a genius in how they're approaching the market. You know, a lot of internet banks have come and gone.
Banking consultant Richard Spear says the online banking business model makes it tough to turn a profit.
You know, 80% of the money that they have, 90% of the money they have is money market money, which can move in a heartbeat.
Banks need more profitable products like loans or CDs to stay in business. Spear says the only proven way to attract those kinds of customers is to open branches.
At the end of the day, the vast majority of consumers prefer to deal with an individual.
Spear says ING's cafes provide that quasi-branch feel, but they don't compare to real branches. The baristas won't cash your paycheck, and if your question is too complicated, they'll direct you to the bank's call center. But even so, marketing professor Barbara Kahn says ING is onto something.
They were ahead of the curve, and now it's something that I think you're going to see a lot of banks do this.
Credit unions have been marketing themselves as friendlier financial institutions. Kahn says small banks direct their officers to join social organizations or sit on community boards to show their engagement. ING Direct teaches basic money management to LA school kids and offers investment seminars at the cafes.
If there's a place where you feel that it's safe and comfortable and a pleasant place to come to, I think that should build loyalty.
On the day I dropped by, ING was having a company party. People lined up at a photo booth, snagged cupcakes, chatted with baristas on their favorite topic.
So, did everything work out? Savings account and everything?
Yeah.
Well, that and they were selling blended drinks for a dollar. Bright orange, of course. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace Podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Last week, we ran a story from reporter Jeff Tyler about tipping, and you responded with all kinds of tips yourselves. Jesse Miller of Ypsilanti, Michigan, shared a cautionary tale about the receipt.
Like Mr. Tyler, I don't tip for to-go orders. However, I had an experience where I'd left the tip space blank but found on my bank statement that I'd been charged an extra 15%. I've since started writing in zero in the tip space and a final total down at the bottom.
Teresa Henneberry hears us in Phoenix. You have no doubt heard of the dine and dash. Well, Henneberry experienced something more along the lines of dine and bash.
One time in California, I was on a dinner date. My date was not pleased with the service, so he left a 10-cent tip. The waiter was not pleased. The dime hit me as I went out the door.
See, you risk bodily harm if you fail to tip for terrible service. But Andy Finley of North Attleboro, Massachusetts, was most disappointed that our story did not deal with the sometimes puny pay for wait and other restaurant staff.
Granted, there are some states out there which have their own laws regarding the wages of tipped employees, but you could have at least mentioned the fact that most servers are almost entirely dependent upon the moods and whims of the people they serve for their livelihood.
All right, go and post your stories on our Facebook page or at marketplace.org/money. And finally to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Rochester, New York, and listener Tom Biganjari. Tom wrote to us with a couple of questions that made us wonder if he just might be pig needy. So we called him up.
My question was how I can spend less time fixated on the market and how to not worry about my financial future, basically, and how to enjoy myself a little bit more, given the fact that I am pretty comfortable financially.
Well, let's start with the first question, which was you told us that you spend a lot of time watching the day-to-day gyrations of the market. What do you think you need to do?
To be honest with you, I think I need therapy. I could probably invest in an index fund and have better returns than I get from trading 500 times a year.
Well, there you go. You answered your own question.
Yep.
And you told us that you're a money hoarder and you're not really sure what you're saving for. What would you rather do with your money? You got any dreams?
If I could do anything that I wanted to, I would open a theater and do live theater.
Wow.
A real money-making venture.
Right. So you want to lose all your money.
Right.
So is there anything perhaps on a smaller scale that you could do?
Well, instead of giving away money, which I do on a really small scale, I would rather, you know, maybe find opportunities to travel and do service work.
Well, these are all great questions, and I want you to keep thinking about them. But in the meantime, you are this week's winner of the Marketplace Money Piggy Award.
Oh, wow.
And it has slots where you can save, spend, invest, and donate.
That's really nice. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks, Tom.
Okay, take care.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, would you let a complete stranger borrow your wheels? Maybe for the right price.
You know, it takes a certain type of open-minded person to decide they want to share their car.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Sonata Lee Narcisse. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.
Masters in puppetry.
Okay.
And which actually exists. And it is, at least for the first year, it's about $30,000.
What?
Whoa. Yeah.
$30,000 for 1 year of puppetry school?
It's through the University of Connecticut.
And how many years is the program?
I'm admitted as a 2-year master's of arts, and then if after the first year I can apply to do the 3-year MFA. So it's 2 or 3 years.
$60,000.
It's an investment in my dream.
Well, it is an investment in your dream, but I do have to ask, what kind of salary do puppeteers make?
Gosh, you know, it's very broad. I mean, generally, puppeteers have several jobs going at once. You know, I think most of them are working as performers as well as teachers.
But, you know, Chris, the reason I'm asking, of course, is because you're starting to really hear this new rule of thumb, at least for undergrad, that you shouldn't take out more student loans than you're going to make in your first year
right.
out of college.
Yeah.
So then, you know, if you're going to grad school and you're going to have, what, $60,000 worth of potential liability there, are you going to make that much?
And the other thing is, do you really need to go to puppeteer school in order to be a puppeteer? Because, you know, in so many artistic professions, there are communities that evolve in neighborhoods, people help each other out. And it turns out that often a master of fine arts or getting some sort of master's degree isn't that important or that necessary.
I mean, that is a good question and one that I've thought a lot about. I don't need it. I could do it another way. But I know people who've done the program. I've seen the work that they come out creating. It is very impressive. And, you know, I want to be at that level. In a pure money standpoint, it would probably involve moving to New York.
Well, then here, I guess we need to get into a little bit more of your life. So what is your financial situation? Would you be able to move to New York if you wanted to?
Well, here's the thing. I also just got married.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you.
Did you both wear big red balls on your nose?
No, he's actually a computer programmer.
Okay.
So, which is another aspect of this picture is that, you know, he's an employable, very valued member of society who can always get a job. I have a Roth IRA and I have an IRA, and we have a small savings account. We just got rid of a lot of his debt.
Mm-hmm.
So we have zero debt. How much should I be trying to save while I'm in grad school trying to pay tuition?
Realistically, you're not going to be able to save anything.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how you save when you're paying for school.
Your savings or your investment is in getting this degree, passing your MFA. So I would look at that as the jargon term that we use. It's your human capital. You're investing in your knowledge. You're investing in your skill. You're investing in your career. And you can think about that as saving, right? Because you're going to make some money off of this over time.
Yeah.
So the real key toward keeping a decent financial situation is to borrow as little as possible.
Okay. So really,
that's what savings means.
Put it all into as much as I can pay for the tuition up front as
yes.
I can.
But let's be clear, we are not saying to, for example, raid your retirement funds.
No.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Don't touch those.
All right.
Well, good luck.
Okay.
I love this story. I can't even tell you
yes.
how much I love it. I just, you know, bravo for following your dream. And thanks for telling us about the crooked line from prison studies to clown school to puppeteer school. I love this.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right, and now we have Daniel in Palm City, Florida. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, very well. Do you have any unique studies that you're doing? Any unique talents that you want to tell us about?
No, I finished with my talents at UCLA a few years back, so
okay.
I'm done with studying.
And what kind of accent do I detect there?
An accent from South America, Argentina.
One of my favorite countries on earth. I loved it so much that I went twice within a year.
Wow.
Yes.
What was that?
A couple years ago.
She told me about all kinds of wines, too.
And wines and meat.
Wines and steak. And probably the friendliest people I've ever met.
Oh, that's
just
nice to hear.
Lovely, lovely, lovely people. I encourage everyone to go visit Argentina.
Please do.
All right, so enough dreaming about my next vacation.
Okay.
How can we help you out today?
Well, I'm in the process of loan modification.
Oh,
unfortunately,
boy.
I bought a house right where I shouldn't have done it, but it's done.
Okay, let me guess how this is going to go. The bank has not cooperated at all. You've had multiple
really
phone calls with different branches of the bank, and nobody seems to have an answer. Nobody knows what they're doing, and you're just fed up.
Well, more than fed up, I'm scared.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I managed to pull a first modification. Loan modification on the first, and I was told...
Oh, so do you have a piggyback loan?
Yeah.
So you have a first mortgage, and then you also have a second mortgage that made up the rest of the mortgage payment.
Exactly.
Okay.
So when I went to meet with the bank representatives a few months back, they told me, we got to work on the first before we can work on the second.
Okay.
Those were their words.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lengthy process. We got it done. It makes sense. It's not wonderful, but it would allow us to stay here.
What, did you get a lower interest rate, or did they modify the principal?
They modify the length, and they modify the rate.
Okay.
So that was good.
Some relief.
We're now at a payment that we can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ready to move on the second. But it turns out that the same lender now doesn't seem to know anything about the second one.
Doesn't know anything about it?
Third party that's calling me, asking me for the money.
Okay. So the first and second mortgage were initially with the same bank?
Yes, they were.
And now someone else is calling you about the second mortgage?
Exactly.
Okay, Chris, I'm guessing this is a mortgage servicer.
That'd be my guess. I think there are a couple things that we can do. One of which is, if you can afford it, I would work with a real estate attorney, someone in your corner. If that's not going to work, there are some nonprofits that are really doing some good work, like, and they're nationwide, Lutheran Social Services, for example, do a terrific job. And they work with a lot of people to try and settle out situations like this. And so I think you're going to need someone in your own camp to help it. It sounds like you've done a lot of the work on your own.
Yes, I have. Because when I tried to get lawyers, everybody that I talked to wouldn't recommend their lawyers. I picked up the advice from all of them, and I did it on my own. But now I'm concerned, and I'm scared.
And you're scared? You're scared because of the phone calls that you're getting?
Well, because I don't know what they can do. I've been paying again for more than 5 months now, and doing everything that the bank told me to do. But
yeah.
I don't know what these other guys can do to me.
Right. You have some real negotiating leverage, by the way, with the second mortgage, because if for happenstance, I mean, this is not going to happen, but if you did go into foreclosure, remember, the second mortgage gets nothing. Everything goes through the first mortgage. So they're actually in a weak negotiating position. But we also don't want you to fall into a scam. There's so many scams out there. You do.
Have you called the bank, the original bank that held the mortgage?
Yeah, and they suggested to have a three-way calling with these guys.
And
when I told that to this other company, they sent me immediately a bunch of paperwork, but they never wanted to have that conversation.
Oh, okay. This is a scam.
I'm not
sure. Maybe it may not
be. It sure sounds like it.
But it doesn't sound good. Now, you have the right to write what's called a qualified written response. QWR is what they call it. And what this says, and you send it in to your bank, and what it does is then they have to respond, who is the servicer? You got to find out who is this company that's getting in touch with you. Do they really own the paper?
When I mention that to them, they don't know who that is.
Exactly. So once you send this in, they have to respond by law, have to find out what's going on, and you start also a written record.
Okay. Yeah, well, I always kept that one.
Good.
Is that something that he can find online, an example of that?
He can find online. There are plenty of examples online. The QWR, this qualified written response. I mean, now, you know, you really find out who actually really does own the second mortgage. And then I would consult with somebody, one of the nonprofits, you know, to try and get some additional information and someone in your corner.
Okay. So it sounds like you have at least a couple of first steps. I would call your bank again and tell them what's happening. And then also, you know, as Chris said, try a couple of these nonprofits, see if you can get some help.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
No, thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah.
All right. And let's go finally to Cherry. And she is in Woodland Hills, California. Hi, Cherry.
Hi, Tess. Hi, Chris.
How are you?
Hi.
I'm good.
Excellent. Excellent. What do you do here in Woodland Hills?
I'm a clinical pharmacist in a hospital here in the San Fernando Valley.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. And do you have any problems with your mortgage? I hope not.
No, I don't have any problems, thank God.
Good.
But my coworkers fall into the exact same situation that we were just talking about.
Really?
And, yeah. Yeah, and she just got her house foreclosed.
Yeah, I
terrible.
Think there are just so many people across the country who perhaps even if they're not going through it themselves, they know someone who is.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, if you don't have a housing problem, then what can we help you out with today?
I have a question regarding a 529 plan. I just have a child 2 months ago.
Oh, congratulations.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. And me and my husband, we both went to graduate school. Especially, I went to pharmacy school, so I have significant school loans.
How much? Give us some details.
When I graduated, it was about 80-something thousand.
Woo!
So I realized how expensive school is, so now I have a son. We wanted to pick a 529 plan, as you guys keep talking about on the show so many times.
Right.
So when I actually do some research, it's very confusing. I don't know which plan to pick, what to look at.
Welcome to
it
the 529 forest.
That's true.
It is a force.
It really is. I mean, we get this question a lot, Chris. But are there ways to know which ones to avoid?
Well, there are. So let me just got a couple ways to go through this. One is by the time your child is 15, 16 years old, you're going to want to have most of the money in cash.
Cash. Okay.
The bill is going to be due fairly soon. So the choices that I like are the ones that are sold directly by the states because they tend to be the low fee options. I do like the conservative age-based option, which is automatic. Okay. And what that means is you'll be more heavily equity when the child is young, and then it becomes more conservative over time. And again, by the time around 16, you want it mostly cash. If you're not comfortable with putting money into equities, then I would just choose the very conservative short-term bond fund option. You won't make a lot of money, but you do just fine. The money will be there when you need it. Again, this is money where you take some risk, but not a lot of risk because the bill would be due. And the thing, and I think Tess got a lot of calls in 2008 from people who all of a sudden realized because of the drop in the market, they didn't have the tuition for sophomore or junior year.
Absolutely.
And that's what you want to avoid. You want to avoid high fees. You want to avoid a lot of equity once your child is in college. And so I would just pick a very conservative option, and the age-based conservative option works for many people.
Okay.
How do I know which one are sold directly from the state?
There's a very, very good website. It's called savingforcollege.com.
Okay.
And it's very good information. It's very well researched. You won't be able to do it in one day, but really, you know, a couple of days looking at the fundamentals, looking at the basics. But since you're in California, California plan is a good plan, by the way. So there's no reason not to do the California plan.
Oh, so I just go to the California plan. That would be good enough.
I think it'd probably be fine. But why don't you go to savingforcollege.com, do a state comparison. Just go there. You can do your research.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Cherry, does that help you out?
Yes. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Terrific.
Guys.
Thanks for the call. Give us a call. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or with your questions, you can also send us an email. Do that at the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Forrest Wilder. I live in Austin, Texas. I'm an environmental reporter for the Texas Observer magazine. Just a standard wallet, folds open. It's camouflage. A couple credit cards, a bunch of business cards, and a few other odds and ends. This is my fishing license, and I carry it in my wallet because I go fishing pretty often. I started fishing at a really young age. I mean, my dad's a hardcore fisherman, and it's what we did for fun. It's not easy at all. In fact, it's really difficult to be a good fisherman, and it requires a real concentration and a kind of awareness of not just yourself, but your environment. It makes you think sometimes like a fish, just kind of a weird headspace to be in.